Erev to everybody. On behalf of Torah Motion, welcome to our weekly Parsha Shir. It's a pleasure to welcome Rabbi Shaul Robinson, who's been the rabbi of Lincoln Square Synagogue since 2005, one of the most important, prestigious shuls in North America. And Rabbi Robinson, as you'll probably hear, was born in Scotland and attended university there. I found it actually quite fascinating. I'd like to get a copy. He wrote his thesis for an MBA on the working lives of rabbis. So I actually am interested in seeing that. The fascinating topic. He was the first person to serve as the full-time rabbi at Cambridge University. And it's among many other accomplishments, but it's a pleasure to welcome him here for our Parsha Shir. Bakasha, Rabbi Robinson.
So delighted to be here. Really, thank you. Real thank you to you, Rabbi Kelman. And the work that you do in Toronto and all over, and especially now your reach has extended, one of those institutions or organizations' as work is extended as a result of COVID and shown us how to be more than local. So yashar koach for everything that you've been doing. And we have a lot to learn. And let me just say to my good friends, and indeed we have relatives in Canada, that I know that Canada, at least the last few weeks or a few weeks ago, was really going through quite a major. Are you in lockdown in Canada, Toronto?
We are in lockdown. Yeah. It's been improving a little, although as I told a few speakers, for a while that we were locked down, our rates were no higher than the States. They just took it more seriously. In other words, they locked down at a much lower level. But now we have slightly higher rates than in the States. But they're getting a little better. But yes, we are in lockdown. No schools are functioning. Online, no entertainment, no restaurants. Everything.
And shuls are closed?
No, shuls are closed. Wow. 10 people maximum. 10 maximum.
Indoors or so we lived through this. It's hard to believe that in New York that was the worst place in the planet, you know, our shuls began to open in June, at the end of June, and have remained open unbelievably. And there's, you know, so anyway, listen, Bezrat Hashem, the whole world is going that please go the direction of Israel. It's a little bit of the topic, my topic tonight, not so much about vaccination. So please go, the world's getting back on its feet, and that you guys will join us in our vaccines, and all will be well. It's a great honor, great privilege to talk. And I thought very carefully about, you know, speaking for Rabbi Kelman and for Torah Motion, and came up with a topic that is, I'm not going to say it's only tangentially related to the Parsha. It's absolutely not. It's based on the Parsha. But normally when I give a Parsha share, and I see at least one of my congregants online, I give a Parsha share, I like to, look at a variety of different views, look at a posuk, or look at a narrative, look at a story, look at the multiplicity of different views. So that's not tonight's shiur. Tonight's shiur, we're going to unpack a famous, but famous for the wrong reason, classic example of late 19th century Torah commentary. That doesn't make you want to sit on the edge of your seat. I don't know what is. But we're going to look at a source which is famous and justly famous, but should be famous for all sorts of reasons. Based on our Parsha, double Parsha this week, Bahar B'chukotai, it is the well-known, I say it's well-known, I'm a product, what Rabbi Kelman didn't say, alluded to, because I come from Scotland, where there is not a huge, it's a small, but not a huge religious community. I didn't grow up in a strictly religious background. When I began becoming religious, and I would attend all of the things that young men and women at university age who want to become religious do, a variety of wonderful and extremely well intended and well organized seminars, Kiruv seminars, each to their own, or Samech, Eshetor, etc. So the source that we're going to look at is taught many times. It's taught an example of rabbinic near prophecy, of how a great Torah scholar can be prescient about what's going to happen in the future, etc. Am I a co-admin? I'm just going to, and it sounds vain, I'm going to spotlight myself. I'm in a little, I always have to explain the sink behind me. I'm not in my bathroom, God forbid, but in New York classic apartments, there used to be maids. And these little maids room, which came with like a little tiny bathroom and wash and sink. So the maid, we don't have a maid, and this is my study, therefore. So anyways, I always like to explain, self-conscious for some reason. I know when you have a rabbi, so I have like Rabbi Kelman behind him, like acres of sforim and books, whatever. Some reason this room isn't set up that way, so I apologize for my sink. But anyway, back to the Meshech Chachma. Rav Meir Simcha Kona Dvinsk is the rabbi whose views or words we're going to be looking at tonight. And looking at an extremely interesting phrase. It kicks off from a phrase that becomes very well known, from Berlin to Jerusalem, a nation. What will happen to people, community that begins to think that their home, Berlin, is in fact, is really Jerusalem. That's the pinnacle of their yearnings, their longings, their religious strivings. Disaster will befall them. And it's a justly famous, very lengthy source. I want to really try and go through it. It's actually really long. It's a long, extended commentary on a verse in our Parsha. But I want to show that it is actually saying way more. And in fact, the point about Berlin and Jerusalem is almost beside the point. It's a prescient commentary and really prophetic. It is prophetic about religious development, the possibilities, the limits of innovation and creativity in halakha, and particularly where those paths diverge between Israel and the diaspora. And this is, to my mind, and only actually I realized sometime last year what this text, to my mind, was really saying, and you can disagree with me, it's fine, but what this text is really saying, and I just last year didn't have with, you know, COVID, at least in New York last year, there was so much more important things to discuss. So I put it to a side, really kind of exploring this text, and decided this year to come to terms with it. I'm going to share my screen. I always get nervous when I do this, still a year into Zoom. I get nervous. Okay, fine. You can see it, share my screen. Now, this text, although on Safari there are one or two, it's a very, very long rabbinic text, Torah commentary, the Meshech Chachma, Meir Simcha Kohn of Dvinsk, famous from his commentary on the Rambam, Maimonides, called the Or Samech, and this work, other works as well, he wrote this work, which he always claimed was his favorite work, the work he took most delight in, the Meshech Chachma, a measure of wisdom, a profound and deep, very dense Torah commentary. Rav Meir Simcha Kohn was kind of one of the products of the high watermark of the Eastern European pre-war yeshiva movement. The commentary of Meshech Chachma, I wasn't able to establish the exact date, but it's written around towards the end of the 19th century. And he was one of the Gedolei Olam, one of the great rabbis of the late 19th, early 20th century. The reason why this text is famous is for this pool quote that I just excerpted from and put at the top of the page just to jog your memory, because you may well have heard this. And he says, it talks about the dangers, Yachshav, what happens when Jews begin thinking, Ki Berlin hi Yerushalayim. When Berlin is Jerusalem and all of the terrible things that they've done, it's an allusion to a verse, what's going to happen to them afterwards? Everybody knows. He predicted the Holocaust. He said there's going to be a time when Jews will think that Berlin is the headquarters of Judaism, is the sum pinnacle of Judaism, and that community will be destroyed. Now, indeed, he does indeed say something like that. He absolutely does. He has a theory of Jewish history that involves, it's not just a theory, it's an observation about Jewish history, that involves Jewish communities constantly establishing themselves, rising in prominence, and then being kicked out and exiled and starting over and over again, over and over and over again, this cycle of Jewish people. What's fascinating is he explains why that happens. The context is our Parsha. Bechukotai is a promise of good times, blessings and reward if we keep the mitzvahs of Hashem. And then, of course, the corollary, but if you don't, if you reject my statutes, then God says, I will pursue you and I will exile you and I'll punish you. And all sorts of horrible, terrible things happen. Interestingly, the end of this set of tochacha, rebuke, curses, however you call it, in contrast to the end of Parshas Ki Tavo and Devarim, in our Parsha, the curses ends with a promise, a overt, a frank and on the place promise of redemption. Even when you're in exile, I will not reject you. I will not despise you. I will bring you back. I will remember the covenant. I will bring you back to the land of your forefathers. So that's a context for this comment. So without further ado, I want to explain what he's doing here. Now, again, it took me a long time to realize this because, frankly, this is a Meshech Chochmah. It's not the world's easiest sefer. You can actually tell, I don't know how many of you ever use the Safaria website or whether it's limited only to we rabbis, educators, share, produce. I'm assuming Rabbi Kalman uses it from time to time. You can generally tell how famous a source is by seeing how many times other people have used it in their source sheets. I don't put my source sheets up in Safaria, but it's always interesting to see how often a particular source has been used by other people. Fascinatingly, this one has been, Meshech Chochmah, and Safaria at least, is quoted only in like two source sheets. And that actually leads me to think that although this is a famous text for the pool quote about Berlin and Jerusalem, the real comment that he's making, which is an astonishingly radical and again, almost prophetic insight into our times, is almost completely overlooked. To the point that I had to constantly ask whether I'm misreading this text. You'll be the judge. I don't think I am. So let's begin with the beginning. We're going to be skipping. If you were to have a copy of Meshech Chochmah in front of you, you'd see this goes on for 6 or 7 pages, and we definitely do not have time to go through the entire thing. But I've done the editing. So this is from the Rabbi Cooperman, who was the founder of Michlala. His comments, and we'll look at his edition of Meshech Chochmah, and we may look at one or two of his footnotes. So he begins with the verse, quoting the verse. V'af, I'm sorry, because this is a screenshot, really, from Otzra Chochmah, I can't highlight the words as we go along, but hopefully you can see my cursor. So he says as follows, V'af gamzo biyotem be'eretz oyveihem, lo ma'asti v'lo galti l'chalot l'haf ebri tiyotem, ki ni Hashem elokechem. Even in your exile, I will not despise you, I will not abhor you, to completely destroy you. I am Hashem. He says, and inyan hu. Here's what's up with this. Shidbonen katsat bidarche ashkachel yonah. Sat mashayuchol lahavim. Let's look a little bit about divine providence to the extent of our limited ability. V'zeh ki kasher gazra chachmel yonah asher Yisrael nodedu ba'artzot shneim rabim ma'od ma'od. The divine providence is decreed in its wisdom. The Jewish people are destined to go through many, many, many years of exile, of wandering amongst the nations. Without getting into the reason right now, Sefer Vayikra has already told us that the land of Israel is intolerant of sin. The land of Israel is not something that any nation can take for granted. And therefore, when we fall short, we will be exiled and exiled for prolonged times. So Jewish survival is not based just in terms of Jewish history and the defense of the land of Israel, but it's based on our ability not to disappear while we're in exile. And that's his premise. Atzman asher chakakah tra'alokit asher lavol mupal lo galia. So until finally all the hidden things will be revealed and the Mashiach will come. Chashvav shenim v'tachbalot asher Yisrael yitkamu legoi v'lo yitbalel ba'amin. So it's always been the enterprise, the responsibility of Jewish leaders, of the Jewish people, to make sure that we do not disappear, assimilate amongst the nations. It's been the responsibility of the leaders of the Jewish people to make gedarim, fences, saigim, hedges, to prevent us from assimilating. It's a beautiful poetic, like old poetic Hebrew. So Jewish people would not be drowned out in the crashing torrential waves of the currents and the storms of history. Who was the first Jewish leader who took responsibility to make sure the Jewish nation did not disappear? Yaakov Avinu. Hu Avinu Azaken Yaakov. Our father Yaakov, a sheret asher yikra otanu b'achrit hayamim, who had prophetic vision about what would befall the Jewish people in the end of days. Chashav asherim haya shivim ish begoy chazav amid k'mitzrayim lifnim. He understood that 70 Jews in a mighty culture like ancient Egypt, alo yitbolalu v'yitbatalu echad b'ravim ravavah, they would have no chance. They would assimilate and disappear very quickly. Chashav tachbulav etza asher banav yimtsuyanim sham. He therefore made rules. Asher Chochman here is quoting a midrash, a famous midrash, that he takes very literally. It's the example, if you like, of the first example of almost rabbinic legislation, patriarchal legislation to stop assimilation. Yaakov Avinu ordained that his Jewish people would be distinct, b'bigdehem, in their garments, missing out, and their language, u'bishmotehem, and in their names. We wouldn't change certain things. Distinct identity. Now this beginning of it is a little lengthy, but it's worthwhile going through, because it really sets up this point that is coming that is astonishing. I hope I'm not overselling this, but that's what I'm here to do. Ulechen ayu Yisrael goy bifnei atzma. Therefore, the Jewish people are a distinct nation. V'imaya Yaakov avi kol shivta Yisrael kvursha. Yaakov further understood that not just giving his nation their own language, their own uniform, their own dress, etc., but he also understood that if he was to be buried in the land of Israel, halo hayu mid yashim eretz kanan v'ayu mishtakeim b'mitzrayim mochshim otam la'eretz moladatam. The Jewish people would give up hope of ever returning to the land of Israel. They would forget the land of Israel. They would begin to see the land of Israel as the land of Egypt as their homeland. Sometimes Jewish leaders have a responsibility. After Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, and I know that Kelman had a relationship with Rabbi Sacks and worked with him on a number of occasions. I remember watching his funeral, and his predecessor, Lord Jacobowitz, was buried in Israel. Kind of almost controversial. I remember like eye-raising at the time when he died. Chief Rabbi of the United Kingdom, German-born Jew, was taken to be buried in Har HaZeitim. But Sacks was buried in an English field, really in a new cemetery, in English. And both kind of felt right. Yaakov Avinu, because Lord Jonathan Sacks was an extraordinary Jew, but it was English to his core. Yaakov Avinu understood that more important than his children being able to visit his grave was the fact that if he was buried in Egypt, the Jewish people would stay in Egypt forever. But Yabatel Yudah Loki Alehem, and they would lose their national purpose, their godly purpose, if they were to see their role as staying in Egypt. Kaloye Zer Avram Rachelek Echad Me'am Yitzrayim. They would no longer be the people of Abraham. It would be an ethnic group, an ethnicity of Egypt. And by the way, it's an interesting point. He points out that you can be culturally Jewish and still assimilate it. It's a fascinating point, and I hope I'm not saying anything controversial, but many, many, many years ago, and I don't know whether he would stand by this today, but Alan Dershowitz, a great Jewish legalist, theorist, controversialist, certainly pro-Israel defender, whatever, wrote a book. I don't even remember the title of it anymore, but it was in response to one of his own children marrying a Gentile who did not convert. And Alan Dershowitz basically said the vanishing American Jew, that's what it's called. And he said the role of the Jewish people is to become an ethnicity in America, like Quakers, like Italians, people who have any, desire for self-perpetuate, but a flavor of American life. The Meshech Chochma describes the fact that Jewish people could easily have become, there could have been a Jewish street in Egypt that people would have gone to see these quaint people, but people who did not regard themselves with any future of their own. So that could never be. So Yaakov Avinu needed to stop that. Therefore, he demanded that he be buried in the land of Canaan, so his descendants would know exactly where they belong. I'm going to carry on with this kind of introduction to make the following point. Skip down to the bottom of this paragraph here. And therefore, naturally is, and Yaakov Avinu, and I know when we do this to our own children, or we make these comments on our own shuls or institutions, are deeply controversial. Yaakov Avinu had to insist to bring up his children to see themselves as strangers. This is not our homeland. This is not our land. I know I'm an immigrant to America, and I know that in America, even in modern Orthodox communities, such statements send us into pretzels of self-consciousness, of twisting ourselves up. predicated of Jewish identity is, no matter how home we are, how grateful, patriotic we are, this is not ultimately our promised land. This is not our future. This is what the Torah means. Vayigar sham, he dwelt there. Melamed shelo yered Yaakov avinu lishtakeh ele gur sham. As we say in the Haggadah, Yaakov needed to teach his children, you're guests here, you're strangers here, you're not Egyptians, you're Hebrews. Perush, melamed ledorot bechol galut vegalut. He's setting in motion a paradigm for every coming exile. Hanhaga, a way of leadership. Shiyodim shelo yordu lishtakeh rag legur la bekeitz yamin. We're only here for the time being. Yinechshavim be'enei atzman v'lo ka'ezrachim, and they should see themselves as strangers and not citizens. Okay. V'chen tziva Yosef, and that's why Yosef told his children that was going to happen as well. V'chen kol ha'shvatim shebezeh nichu shoresh gadol b'lav Yisrael. And that's what the very earliest generation of Jews, Jacob and the tribes, gave over to the children. U'lechen, they could to be fled in Israel. That created anti-Semitism. That created a revulsion on behalf of the Egyptians. Shenech shavim b'neihem kekotzim. They looked to the Jews as thorns in their sight. Shemo shekotzim in nisbach v'osei sharashim b'sharnatim v'lenot. Ken hayunech shavim Israel. Jewish people were strangers, kept themselves apart from apart. Shodimo edatzim l'Yisrael v'yunifradim. They had different aspirations, different behaviors, different emotions. Until they were literally a thorn in the side of the Egyptians. Now, just give me one set. Fine. Now he goes on. Now he jumps 2,000 years. And he begins to talk about halacha, which is not apparently connected. And you'll see what I mean in a moment. If I was the editor of the Meshech Chochma, this Sefer, and I'd received the manuscripts, I would have been seriously concerned that something had happened and the pages had become mixed up. Because this text that we're going to spend another half an hour or so going through is full of almost non sequiturs, almost paragraphs that don't quite link up until you realize what he must be saying. So he says this paradigm that the primary role of Jewish leaders is to stop Jewish people disappearing, no matter how unpopular that might make us, is something from the very dawn of history, Jewish history. And from this they learned the great ones of our nation, Uberosham Ezra of Anshe Knesset HaGadola, the prophet Ezra, Ezra the scribe, the men of the great assembly, Shagad Ruvisago Uma Bishmona Esra Davar, that made 18 rabbinic acts of legislation. Now, there's an interesting note here, and it seems that this text, maybe he gave this over as a drosh and shul, when rabbis get up in front of shuls, at least I do, you begin exaggerating a little bit, you begin, you know, not 100% quoting sources, etc. Rabbi Cooperman, who has tremendous respect for Meshech Chochma and this extremely useful commentary, points out this statement is just a little bit off. It's not Ezra and the men of the Anshe Knesset and Gedolah. He's referring to, if you're familiar with the Mishnah, the end of the Mishnayot, at the end of the first chapter of Mishnah Shabbos, talks about the earliest forms of records of rabbinic legislation we have, many of which are to do with Tumah and Tahara, the laws of purity and impurity, but more importantly, many of them, and from the same era, are to do with things that have prevented us from assimilating. Does merely entering the land of Israel, or leaving the land of Israel, make you impure? The food, the bread, the milk, the wine of Gentiles. Basically anti-assimilationary bedrock early rabbinic legislation. So he says the rabbis, and again, he puts it at the very beginning of what we might call rabbinic era, the men of the great assembly, learned from Jacob, Yaakov, Avinu, and made rules against assimilation. To keep us away from the Gentiles, or separate from the Gentiles, we should say, not away, but distinct in all their ways. So Jewish people should know that we're guests. V'gerba aretz nochria, and that we're strangers in a foreign land. K'shtili zeitim she'enu mitarev im harchavad acheret. We're like olive shoots that are not supposed to be grafted on to a host. Ulechen, and now look what he says. Ulechen amru b'Yerushalmi. Now, Rabbi Kupperman points out that this statement is not actually in the Talmud Yerushalmi, it's actually in Talmud Bavli. Nonetheless, Ulechen amru b'Yerushalmi, shafilu Eliyahu, einu yachol levatel. These very early, the question, which we'll return to in a moment, when rabbis make rules, do you have to follow them forever? It's one of the great questions of halachic debate creativity. If I tell my congregation, you know, shul's closed, so it doesn't mean it's also ever to go to shul, temporary enactment for the circumstances. Obviously, when we think about dinei derabanan, gezerot, rules, enactments of the sages, of chazal, the situation is much more complicated. The general rule, which he's going to talk about in a moment or two, is that once the sages made a rule, it can't easily be annulled. You would need, for example, either clear proof. There's a beautiful tshuva of Rav Osher Weiss, where he goes through when do we say bottle tam, bottle gezerah. The classic example, by the way, contemporary halacha, the reason why you're not supposed to take pills and medication on Shabbat, absent real illness, is because of a concern that you might come to grind the herbs and spices that go into, the ingredients. You might come to grind up your own. We're not apothecaries. We don't make our own medication. So does that apply or not? But a general rule of thumb is that when the rabbis make an enactment, you can't just disregard it. Sometimes you can. Theoretically, a greater bet then could come along and annul it. So the Gemara says an interesting thing, a fascinating thing, about this early bedrock legislation. The earliest legislation of the rabbis that is designed to prevent us to assimilating, which is, filu Eliyahu Navi, shafilu Eliyahu Einu Yachol Levatlo. Oh, one second. I'm so sorry. I just got an urgent message, and this is entirely highly unprofessional. Sorry.
It's fine. The job of a busy rabbi.
No. I just got a message that said that somebody found my daughter's driving license.
The job of a busy parent.
Exactly. Okay, done. I bet you weren't. I wouldn't have noticed otherwise if I had a notification that popped up on my screen. I don't know whether you saw it or on the outside. Anyway, so back to this. So what he's saying is as follows. There's some kind of gezerah that even Eliyahu the prophet could not be mevatel, could not come along overturn. Perush, kozman shelo bo'agol v'sig shivud machio. That is to say, as long as the Messiah hasn't come and we're still in exile, even if Eliyahu Novi were to come along and say, Mashiach is coming on Monday, and we would say, Mashiach is coming on Monday, can we have non-Jewish wine in the meantime? The answer would be no. No. Lo yivatlu. Shehen hen advarim amikayim le'uma begola. Because these things are what keep the Jewish nation alive in diaspora, the rules that the rabbis made to stop us assimilating. Yisrael reminds us that we're Jewish, and we're in a land that's not ours. So Mashiach Chachma is, as we know, where does Berlin, Jerusalem fit into all of this? He's making a statement about the role of Jewish leaders is to make sure that we don't assimilate, and the role of Jewish leaders is. We don't assimilate to the extent that even Eliyahu the Navi would not be able to undo these bedrock rabbinic legislations. So let me go on with this and we'll see where he's taking this. Now I am selectively editing out parts of this for time reason. So then remember what I said a few moments ago, that if this, you know, I would be worried if I was the editor of this manuscript, that the pages and the paragraphs have got somehow or other transposed. because he now starts talking about, and I missed out a paragraph, but it's this paragraph summarizes it. He now starts talking about Jewish history. The way of Jewish history will be that we will come to a land and then we'll be exiled and sent away and we'll eventually come to a new land and we'll regroup. And he describes this pattern of Jewish and human history. He says a fascinating, fascinating thing. He says, "Kacha yachliv matzav ha-Yisraeli v'kiyumo ba'amim." This is how it's going to go for the Jewish people and how it's going to keep us alive in exile. Kasher ein hamaskil yirah b'sefer divrei yamim. Just like you could read the book of the divrei yamim and see this all kind of unfold. And this pattern of coming to a new community, establishing ourselves, being poor, and then being rich, being establishing Torah institutions, and then eventually getting so secure that we are made to leave. This is just the pattern of Jewish history. V'zeh l'shtei sibot. And this happens for two reasons. This pattern of exile, rebuilding, consolidation, and then further exile. Happens for two reasons. L'kiyum hadat emiti v'tarato, to keep Judaism alive, ulekiyum ha'uma, and to keep the nation of Israel alive. And by the way, it's a fascinating thing to note. I was Bar Banel on our parsha makes an extremely interesting point that as it happens, exile is often, we think of exile and destruction of Jewish communities and things which cause tremendous disruption and loss of life as, you know, unmitigated disasters for the Jewish people. The Bar Banel points out in the sweep of Jewish history that, in fact, that's also the key to Jewish survival, because many nations were destroyed when they were concentrated in one place. Many nations we barely remember from history. Think about Troy. Remember Troy? Troy was destroyed. It was a people, a nation, a state that was basically destroyed by the Greeks, all of them, because there was no Trojan diaspora. All the Trojans lived in Troy, and they were all destroyed, basically. That never happened to the Jewish people. Think about, God forbid, in the time of the pogroms in the late 19th century, the Jews fleeing Russia to save their lives, to make a better life for themselves in America, could not have a conception that in fact they were saving their families from the coming Holocaust, because the future is hidden to us in its entirety. So he says this pattern of exile and rebuilding and new exile has two purposes. One, to keep Judaism alive, and one, in fact, to preserve the Jewish people. Ki kasher yinuach Yisrael ba'amim, now he makes a point, and this is the point where we just have to lean in a tiny bit. He's going to say something a little involved. Ki kasher yinuach Yisrael ba'amim, when the Jewish people are at rest amongst the nations, yafriach v'gadel torotal pilpolo, they begin to excel in Torah study. Ubenav yasuchal, later on he'll describe that process in more detail. And then the children will grow up and become strong in their own right. Gadru neged avotehem. And they'll want to take stands kind of in opposition, in contrast to their parents. Kikacha chafetz adam asher arachron yichadesh yotziv omet mashen alem bedori yashan. It is human nature to want to innovate, to respond, to critique, to build on, and sometimes to pull down what the previous generation have built. It's human nature. That's how human progress works. A mythical idea that until the 1980s, the academic study, there was an accepted canon of revered wisdom, the classics, Greeks. You know, I'm familiar with the book from back in the day, Alan Bloom, The Closing of the American Mind. But the notion that, our generation was the first to turn to the wisdom, received wisdom of its parents, its civilization, and say, we want to look at the world differently. The idea that somehow we were taught that never happened before is clearly nonsense. Human nature is to look at the world, look at your parents' world, sometimes to want to better it, and sometimes to want to pull it down. That's how progress happens. That's how actual human progress. Every generation is iconoclastic to the generation that came before. And that is not necessarily a terrible thing. He says, "V'zeh b'chachmat enoshit," in human sciences, "asher makorah machshavat sechel enoshi," that are based on human knowledge, human understanding, secular wisdom, science. And he says, "V'zeh yigadru achronim yotzif ometz kasher neroad b'chol dor." We see, and that's how human progress is made. And that can sometimes be, at the same time, very destructive. But by definition, it works in kind of an opposition. It's a dialectic. It's an idea. And then there's a new idea that are kind of in contrast. He says that when it comes to Torah, the new contributions of the new generation are not in conflict with the earlier generation. He's going to say the opposite of we expect a highly conservative religious Lithuanian yeshiva scholar to say. New ideas from a new generation are not in contrast, are not threatening, and are not destructive to the values of the previous generation. Look at the last paragraph, last line. Lochen hadad aloki anita min ha-shamayim. That's not true of heavenly knowledge that comes from heaven. It's not hewn out from earthly knowledge. Halo im haya be'eretz Yisrael lifnim. If we were living in the land of Israel back in the day, every generation, I have never seen a text that speaks as frankly in this way. Back in the day, when we lived in Eretz Yisrael, and we had, as he'll describe, prophecy or Ruach HaKodesh, whatever you want to call it, there was an immense capacity and potential for halachic innovation. There is nothing more natural than a generation with different views, priorities, agendas, tastes, beliefs than its predecessor's generation. And that would have been fine. They would have been able to gader b'tikun uma in the natural governance of the Jewish nation, kol echad lefi doro, the nation, each one according to his generation. Bet din hagadol haya yichol lebatel divri bet din hamakodem. If the rabbis had inherited, so Sanhedrin saw that rules made a generation ago don't work for our, not talking about Torah law, rabbinic enactments. We saw that they don't work, they don't serve the needs, the priorities of a new generation. No problem, change them. Uma shenidrash b'yud gimel amidot. Even things which are learned out from the 13 hermeneutical principles, which is an extremely radical statement because we often consider them actually dine doraita, the rabbis would have been able to put a spin on it. This is not a stretch. Do not ban me. Do not suddenly kick me off the Zoom, Rabbi Kalman. It is not a stretch to say on the basis of this that if a particularly, a generation with a particular set of needs decided that they needed to take eye for an eye literally, they would have been able to do so. Even though no Bet Din ever did, according to the Rambam, or Ibn Ezra, no generation ever did that way, that would have been in their power to do. That was the scope of the rabbinic ability to be mechadesh, to innovate halacha in those days, and they were not bound by the rules or the interpretations of previous generations. Af bet din katan hayachol laharot ofen hayashar beinayim. Even a lesser bet din would have been able to overturn the words of an earlier greater bet din. Amazing statement. Vera biyom akibur. So then he gives an interesting proof. I brought the proof in the foot for the. We're not going to get into the proof, and to my mind, he could maybe have brought other proof. He brings an interesting proof that even though we consider the shiurim, the amount of food that, if you, God forbid, eat in Yom Kippur, that you're going to be chayv mitzah over, chayv karis over, we consider that a din deraita, a Torah law. He actually shows that, in fact, in essence, it's derived by a bet din, a rabbinic law. The Gemara says the bet din of Yavetz, of the Nevi'im, instituted that particular rule. So what he wants to show is that there was tremendous halachic creativity when we lived in Eretz Yisrael. And let me just... In Nevi'im, Okay, once I beg your pardon. Fine. All right, let's talk about Yom Kippur. So I'm missing out this paragraph. So let's just pick up here at the end of this paragraph and go to the next page. And notwithstanding this, notwithstanding the stature of any Bet Din, we're talking about a time when there was always a Hofa Eloki Ruchanit, prophecy and religious inspiration. Milvan Migdash Rishon, not even only in the first temple, Shishare Alehen Aruach, where certainly there was prophetic prophecy by Yenuvim, Bnei Novim, Vasifet Balechachim, Avtara, Muskel, Lezek Asher, Kedav Rambam, Bechut Yisrael Torah. Maimonides in the Hilchot Yisrael Torah basically says that prophecy is almost a natural phenomenon, that if a person is so qualified and so has got all the correct capabilities, then prophecy just comes automatically, naturally. So not just in the times of the first temple where there were lots and lots of prophets around, and therefore they could incorporate religious change without violating the divine will, by Urim V'Tumim, and they also had the Urim V'Tumim. Even after Mikdash Sheni, Amru Shisham Shovim Ruach HaKodesh, even in the times of the second temple, there was sufficient divine inspiration, Ruach HaKodesh, by Guloy Or Elokit Hamid Chofef, divine light was always manifest. Asher lo yidua ador melifnim, umin hagna shel uma benehem asmanim kasher yom mishpat mitzur lahem ledor laratsha shashaya tzrika lakach. And therefore, the Jewish authorities in the land of Israel, the time of the first temple, the second temple, had extraordinary latitude to incorporate the inevitable demands of a next generation for change, for the ability to look at the world differently, to live their lives differently from previous generations. And that was easily incorporated. And a prophecy or Ruach HaKodesh would be a break, a check against that. We're not talking about a nation decided to go worship idols. We're talking about people who were able to be in conformity with the divine will. Lochen Begola. But that's not true in the diaspora. Shenid Ma'ed HaKibbutz Vasifa Belima de Torah, where we are poorer in Torah study. Let me just get to the next page. Shemitam Zeh. Okay, this is the footnotes. We're just going to add to this. Mitam Zeh Ein Rashut L'Shum Beit Din L'Chadesh Davar. In the diaspora, when the temple is destroyed and we're sent into exile, the rule is that we're not allowed to change any rabbinic law. Moshe could have a Rambam, but I'm all to say for Mishnah Torah, as the Rambam writes, I happen to be studying a course right now in Revo Graduate School, the Maimonidean Controversy with Professor David Berger, and the Mishnah Torah, the Rambam itself, extremely radical, important work, and his Hekdama, his introduction, extremely important statement of how the Rambam viewed the power of Halakha. Ein Sham Chosev and Navi, Umechitza Shabbat and Masad ben Yisrael, Avin Shem Shemayim. Right now, we live in a time without prophecy, and it's as if there is an iron curtain that separates us from the divine will. So what he's saying, and this point can so easily be missed, is that in Eretz Yisrael, when we lived in Eretz Yisrael, and when we had Nevuah, or even not Nevuah, just a Beit HaMikdash, in the ability to be extremely creative in halacha. Not creativity for the sake of creativity, creativity for the sake of halachic need. In the diaspora, that door is closed to us. Now remember I said, right at the beginning, if you do remember, that this seems, unless we're careful, to be a series of non sequiturs, of ideas that don't apparently link up. But let's just review and recap what he's telling us until now. Number one, the first job of Jewish leadership is to ensure that we don't assimilate in the diaspora. The earliest band, the earliest strata of rabbinic legislation we have is to prevent assimilation. And there's a rule that even Eliyahu Navi, the prophet Elijah himself, could not undo those rules. Because in the diaspora, the role of Jews is to stop assimilating. That's our mission, not to assimilate. And rabbinic law, which is designed to stop us assimilating, has to be fixed. What would happen if we decided in diaspora to assimilate and we had the ability to repeal rabbinic law of earlier generations? We'd repeal it. The first hurdle, the first party with non-Jewish wine that we wanted to go to, we would get a bet then and we would find a reason. And before you know it, we would all have been assimilated. So what he's explaining is that exile and halachic conservatism go hand in hand. Really, halacha is creative and deeply responsive to this human that he looks at benignly, this natural human instinct to want to innovate, to want to clash, to contend with the world you inherit, to make your own world. In theory, that instinct is entirely compatible with Torah, because the Torah is huge. Shivim panim, the Torah. The Torah is full of infinite possibilities and therefore has a capacity for tremendous creativity, but not in diaspora. In diaspora, halacha goes into voluntary exile, because if it wasn't frozen, we would assimilate. We would disappear. That's it. We would disappear because it's the conservative, frozen nature of the halachic system that prevents us from disappearing. And that's why I said this, you know, looks like even the pages of the manuscript got mixed up, because now he's going to go back to talking about the great, you know, waves and torments and storms of exile. And let's just carry on with this for 5 minutes, and I'm going to leave time for questions. And then I have a very hard stop at 9:30 because I have another meeting. Kachi Dorche Shaluma. This is the nature of the Jewish people. Kasher Yichnesu La'eretz Nochriya. We come to a foreign land. Yuenem B'nei Torah. And by and large, the people who immigrate to new land are not going to be B'nai Torah. Maybe because, like in Russia, the rabbi said, don't go to America. Or maybe because nobody can afford, if you're a poor immigrant living in an immigrant community, whatever your economic standing was in the old country, you're starting off from scratch. You don't have time to sit and learn in Kollel. There's no such thing as afternoon Seder, night Seder. Kasher nidlo min mitzvah people who are fleeing persecution do not have time for intellectual pursuits. In fact, but then there's an awakening. There's a religious awakening. You can think of any diaspora community that came, that established itself. The first generation were well-intentioned, maybe highly traditional, but not Torah scholars. But they succeed almost miraculously the following generation of raising a generation of scholars, of building institutions. Yarbitzu Torah, the Torah increases. Yasu Nifla'ot, they do amazing things. Adki, whatever you are in the religious spectrum, one day the Mitzvah Hashem will open the border. I love going to Israel. Bezrat Hashem, I'll be in Israel in a few weeks' time. Bezrat Hashem. But even lacking Israel, when I go to Lakewood, New Jersey, I just love it. It's a high for me. Because to see a place that has built Torah, might be a slightly different flavor, but to build a place that has built Torah, unbelievable power, it fills every Jewish heart with a tremendous sense of pride. That's what he's describing. They do wonders. Ad ki yamod kera Torah, asher ruma b'si, until the Torah is at the highest level. Halo ein biyad hador chadash la'osif ma. But then what's going to happen to the next generation? Think about it. Post-war America, I'm sure post-war Canada as well. You have a poor generation, but they manage to scrabble and they manage to lay down institutions. And then you have the generation after that, who are the good, caring, institutional leaders, consolidators, builders, your shul presidents and your yeshiva presidents and wonderful Jews. Your generation, our generation. And then what? The next generation. Next generation, you can't take anything for granted. Anything. At all, because the natural way is for the next generation to want to make their own world. And what happens? Many kids will say, I don't want this. I want something else. So what's going to happen when that happens? There's nothing left for the new generation to accomplish. Now, interesting enough, he's writing in 19th century Russia, where there was a sense, I think, of, you know, a religious ennui setting in, that there's tremendous amount of, if not assimilation, of people giving up observance, because it doesn't seem that there were alternatives. Nowadays, in the modern Orthodox community, you see two distinct patterns. You see many kids going off the derech. You also see many, a smaller number, but not insignificant by any means, of kids who are becoming either neo-Hasidic or flipping out or going to the fascinating, fantastically, and this might be because of Israel, we actually have a world where there is room for religious innovation that doesn't mean religious rebellion. But that's not the world the Meshech Chachma is describing. Inevitably, many people of the next generation will rebel. And he said, because they have no choice. What are the next generation going to do? Gader neged avutam. When they rebel, how are they going to rebel? What's going to happen to the natural human instinct to contend with the previous generation? They're going to forget what it means to be a Jew. Before long, they're going to be saying, Torah, Judaism, our parents' way of life, it's all falsehood. Israeli bechlal yishkach machsav tov yichshav leEzrach Ranan. The Jew is going to forget his mission and he's going to start thinking of himself as a citizen of America, Canada, Germany. Yazov limud dato, he's going to start learning his religion. Lilmod l'shanot lolo, he's going to learn foreign languages. Yaliv mekal talam velo yaliv mitakanta, he's making a biblical allusion. Yachshav ki Berlin hi Yerushalayim. There's that quote. He's going to think that Berlin is Jerusalem. He's going to forget Jewish aspirations. He's going to reject Jewish aspirations. I'm not Jewish. I'm German. But al tismach Israel gil kamim. And now we're going to come to the end. Ka, one second. I'm on the wrong page. And he says, and that's what's going to happen in every generation. As yavor ruach soav esar. So what's going to happen? The next generation is going to start assimilating. So how is God going to stop us assimilating? How is he going to prevent it? We don't have in the diaspora the ability to be religious innovators, to make a halachic system that meets our precise needs in contrast to our parents. Because in diaspora, halacha is frozen. So how does God solve this problem for us? As Yavor Ruach Tov Asar, Yakor otanu migezo yenichil legoy merachok asher lilmad lishono yadak yuger. We're going to be reminded. We're going to be sent into further out. We'll be kicked out of England, of Germany, of Spain, France, of Russia. We'll be chased away. Yadak yuger. We'll be reminded that we are foreigners. Lishono safar kochenu. It won't matter. The ability to speak German anymore won't matter when we come to America. We'll realize that we were in exile all along. Foreign language, a foreign culture is just like a set of clothes that you change, a suit of clothes. But in our origins, we're Jews. And again, it's going to happen again. We'll come as a poor generation to a new land. Remember we're Jews, because what other identity do we have? We'll build new institutions and it'll all start again. And that's inevitable. That's how it will go. Kachi derech Yisrael miyom yotom mitnoded. This is how it's been for the Jewish people all in our exile. Puchazi, and then he quotes various examples from Jewish history. So look, this is all we have time for now. And he goes on to relate it to the verse. But I just want to recap and review just in the couple of minutes remaining what the Meshech Chachma here has done. And remember, this is a very difficult, this Meshech Chachma, the Berlin to Jerusalem Meshech Chachma that I learned in Eisha Torah Discovery seminars, however many years, 35 years ago, is this Meshech Chachma. And indeed he's saying, as a result of Jews feeling too at home and assimilating, exile is inevitable result. But he's saying so much more than that. And this explains to me so much about what's happening in the Jewish world. Because even though, of course, Eretz Yisrael Mashiach has come, we do not have the Beit HaMikdash. He's making a trenchant observation that is deeply relevant and explains a lot about what's happening in our times. In the diaspora, and I'd say this is a rabbi of a shul, and a rabbi of a well-known shul, and a rabbi of a liberal-leaning Orthodox shul. No matter how much I like to kid myself sometimes, nobody, Lincoln Square Synagogue is not a hard, you know, it's not a right-wing modern Orthodox synagogue. It's not. It's wonderful people with wonderful values. And my members are deeply frustrated at this point that halakha seems to be ultra-conservative. And paradoxically, in Israel, lots of things are happening and begin to happen. We can think about, you know, I don't know whether Rabbi Kalman is on, and I'm not really supposed to quote it. Rabbinic Council of America, at least on their email list, bless them, seem to be horrified by the very idea that the Jews of Efrat could appoint a woman rabbi to a synagogue whilst not apparently, you know, failing to keep the OU's guidelines on the matter. And, you know, they can't understand why Jews in Efrat do not see themselves bound by rabbis in New York. But in the diaspora, the primary role of the Jewish community is to prevent, is to stop ourselves disappearing. And therefore, says Meshech Chachma, halacha by definition is conservative, because indeed it's a valid concern. Once you start undoing not just rabbinic law, but mores and customs and traditions, it's not an invalid question to say, well, where does it end? Where does it end? In Israel, those concerns are less manifest. And therefore you see an astonishing, maybe even this summer, but the last few summers, I went and spent a month learning in the Bet Midrash of Yeshivat Haretzion, the Gush, a proper yeshiva. Yeshiva full of rabbis and Talmidei Chachamim. But a place of intellectual curiosity and breadth and openness, and even openness to new Piskei Halakha, that is almost unknown in America. And therefore, the Meshech Chachma is not just predicting presciently that the Jews back in Israel will begin to develop a halacha much more open within all the halachic guidelines. But they won't be tortured by this notion of, well, if we allow this, it will lead to mixed dancing or mixed marriage. And therefore, the halacha returns to a certain sense of its own creativity, all of which is the original purpose. The original purpose of halacha is not to say no and to thwart new ideas and new generations, but in fact, to live with them and encourage them to be modern and creative. If I were to finish this on one pithy line, I would say modern orthodoxy is the original orthodoxy, because Judaism was always supposed to be creative to the needs of each and every generation. Okay, Ad kan.
Thank you very much. Yes, yasher koach, a very, I think, wonderful insight. And it is very true, the creativity. And, you know, we're both members of the RCA, and we know some of the discussions that are going on behind the scenes, and rabbis who in America had one position, moved to Israel and changed their position. And that's not a bad thing, I don't think. Okay, just very, very quickly, thank you very much, before we let you go, because I know you said you have a meeting. There's one question somebody pointed out, very interesting comment, really. And your comment about Troy. So we don't want all Jews living in Israel. Because, you know, there is that idea, you know.
We have a member of our shul called Giddy Greenstein. He's an interesting fellow, and he's a big sort of Israel NGO type of person. And he wrote a book a number of years ago. Actually, Rabbi Sachs at Sal was actually very taken with this guy, Giddy. He wrote a book called Flexigidity, all about how the secret, and we actually had a dialogue in 1 year in the middle of the night at Shavuot on exactly this topic. Giddy actually maintains, he's a secular Jew, he actually maintains that, it would be the survival of the Jewish people in exile has always, or of Jewish peoplehood, has always been on this notion that if one community is destroyed, another will survive. That's what Yaakov Avinu did. When Esav came towards him, he split his camp in two. Of course, I would love all the Jews to live in Israel and let it happen. And I guess we would have to pull out the card and say, you know, we'll have to rely on the divine protection card, because otherwise, strategically, don't sell your shares and put them all in Bitcoin. Don't put them all in Bitcoin. Don't put all your eggs in one basket. Strategically, that's a bad idea. But I guess historically, we should say there will come a time when God will not want us to be exiled any longer, and he will bring us back to the land, I guess.
Although I'm not sure that even in the, listen, in Yemot HaMashiach, there's, I don't know there's anything written that every Jew is going to live in Israel.
I remember once when I was a rabbi at Cambridge University, I had a student who was, you know, very firm, had learned of the Mir, but was, you know, could not stand the idea of living in Israel. So he, there's a Gemara in Gittin that says that, you know, one day the borders of Eretz Yisrael will basically extend all the way through the Medrash. So he tried to convince that, you know, Mashiach comes, Golders Green will be part of Israel. So we can stay here. Right. We just, you know, it'll be Israel, it'll be Eretz Yisrael. It's just we, it will be in Golders Green. So, yeah, maybe.
Okay. Yasher Koch, thank you very much.
Anyway, I enjoyed this very much. And thank you so much for the opportunity.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. And tomorrow morning, my Pirkei Avot, 9:30 a.m. Everybody's invited. Sunday morning, Rabbi Daniel Feldman, 10 a.m., Halacha and Human Relations, Rabbi Liktak on Shavuos, all our classes. So hope forward to learning with you, seeing with you, invite a friend, and it's very nice. Okay, everybody, if we don't see you beforehand, Shabbat Shalom, and thank you very much. Okay, I think, the Parsha Shir doesn't get any Israelis, or is anybody here from Israel? It's like 4 o'clock, it's 4:30 in the morning. So it's good talking to B'nai Chutz Laretz, but anyways, okay, thank you very much. Anybody's in comments? Okay, Laila Tov.
Thank you, good night.
Thank you. Good night.
Thank
you. Something to think about.
Yeah. The truth of the matter, see, the Meshech Chochmah, it's good. I know the Berlin Yerushalayim, that's the famous part of the Meshech Chochmah. He went over the less famous parts of the Meshech Chochmah. But, the Meshech, listen, the Meshech Chochmah was a big Zionist, you should know. He was the one with the Balfour Declaration. He came out that the Gemara, the Ksuvos, and the three oaths didn't apply because of the Balfour Declaration, whatever. He was, whatever. Like all these rabbis, they were fascinating.
You know. I have it. I did it from the Sefer.
I'm sorry?
I did it from the Sefer.
I have Rabbi Cooperman, the three volume.
Rabbi Cooperman.
The green edition. It's very interesting. That was Rabbi Cooperman's magnum opus, the Meshech Chochmah. That was his love, you know. I met Rabbi Cooperman once, when the one time I davened in Miklala. When I was in Gross and they needed a minion in Miklala, whatever. But that's an interesting story for another time. I think, but anyway.
I had him in Miklala.
Oh, you were in Miklala. I won't ask what year. That wouldn't be nice of me.
In 74.
In 1970. I didn't ask.
It's fine.
Yeah. Okay. Very good. All right. Thank you. Okay. Lila to everybody. Okay. Bye-bye.